Welcome to Water for Fighting, where we discuss the past, present, and future of water in Florida with the people who make it happen. I'm your host, Brett Cyphers. This episode's discussion is brought to you by Sea and Shoreline and Resource Environmental Solutions. Sea and Shoreline is the Southeast's leading innovator in protecting coastal communities from devastating storms and restoring ecosystems that once faced ecological collapse. Visit their website at seaandshoreline.com. And of course, Rez. Rez is the nation's leader in ecological restoration, helping to restore Florida's natural resources with water quality and stormwater solutions that offer communities guaranteed performance and outcomes. Check them out at res.us. If you enjoy the discussions here on Water for Fighting, I think you'll also want to check out the Florida Specifier and the Florida Specifier podcast. The Specifier has become Florida's environmental news source of record, and the podcast is your go-to place for staying up to speed on environmental news and newsmakers here in the Sunshine State. You can join the discussion as we explore the latest environmental news and developments that matter to you. Go to floridaspecifier.com to learn more. All right. I know I'm limping toward the finish line here on season four, but I think the wait is going to be worth it to those of you who listen. We are indeed finishing strong, and there's no better example of that than today's guest, and that's Temperance Morgan. Temperance has a distinguished career in public service and the nonprofit sector, working on protecting vast and iconic natural resources and addressing critical environmental restoration and water resource issues. She's been the director of Everglades Policy and Coordination at the South Florida Water Management District, and has also worked with the Florida Department of Environmental Protection, managing water quality standards and restoration. Temperance joined the Nature Conservancy in 2014 as the executive director for Florida, and she currently serves as the division director for the Nature Conservancy's Southern U.S. Division. Temperance Morgan, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Brett. It's a pleasure to be here.
Yeah, I'm really glad to have you. I think you probably heard by now from our mutual friend and your colleague, Greg Connect, that this kind of cranks right into the very beginning, and I want to dig deep into your life before we talk about your career. And so let's start, shall we, with your family and your family roots. I've read that you're a fourth generation Floridian, and so let's explore that just a little bit into some of the where's and when's there. Maybe start with your parents and see if we have to work back from there. Where are your parents from?
So my parents are both from Florida. It's becoming a more unique situation to have the opportunity to have both of your parents born here. My mom was born in Jacksonville and my dad was born in Okeechobee.
And how did they meet? Because that's a pretty fair distance from each other.
It is. As in many small towns in the state, they had families that had connections. So at a variety of different gatherings over the years, they crossed paths. There was no blood relation there, but they crossed paths in those gatherings and ended up dating. At the time, my dad worked on a cattle ranch in the Okeechobee area, and my mom, having been born in Jacksonville and traveled back and forth living in Jacksonville and in LA, was quite the city girl. So that was an interesting match from the beginning.
Yeah, it sounds like it. Now, kind of dipping just slightly deeper in the root zone, if you will, with your folks, were both their sets of parents from those respective areas, Jacksonville and Okeechobee, or is there some, you know, person that came from somewhere else in that picture?
Yeah, great question. So on my mom's side, I'm entirely Norwegian. So my mom's mother and father both came from the Minnesota area, where their families moved over from Norway, you know, many years ago, and there's a strong Norwegian community there. So my mom's roots are from Minnesota, and my dad's roots, as I mentioned earlier, go back in Florida for both of his parents, a little farther on his dad's side, which is where we pick up that fourth generation, multi-generational residents of Florida on my dad's side.
On that side, is the multi-generation also involved in the ranching industry, or was it something else, you think?
Yeah, so my father's father and his family really grew up living off the land, and a generation where you grew your own crops and you hunted and fished for what was going to be on the dinner table. Mm. And if you weren't successful that day, there wasn't going to be much to eat, you know, a large family. And as my dad grew up and his siblings grew up, moving back and forth from Pearson, Florida to Okeechobee, Florida, a number of my family members, including my father, got involved in the ranching industry and the farming industry in the Okeechobee area.
I was going to say, like you mentioned, you threw a Pearson reference in there, which is, I would say, certainly closer to Jacksonville than Okeechobee, that's for sure. But another kind of small place in Florida that I don't think people know much about. How long did you have family that was living, you know, in Pearson?
Again, for multiple generations, my grandfather, as a child, moved back from back and forth from the kind of the Pearson area, you know, upper central Florida, and back down to the Okeechobee area. Those small communities had a lot of family connections. And so my grandfather grew up between those areas, which is somewhere of some of that overlap happened with my mom's family. So as a child, and we can get into this more as we go, but as a child, I spent a lot of time visiting my dad's family, either in the Okeechobee area, which really exposed me to the, you know, cattle industry, which is where many of them worked, as well as seeing some of my dad's siblings that kind of homesteaded in the Pearson area.
It leads me to that kind of weird spot, I guess, and, you know, whatever my mom said went in our family in terms of where we lived. It's like, is that why your folks ended up settling in Jacksonville as the place where they would live and start a family?
That's funny you should ask that, Brett. I kind of led on to this when I was speaking earlier about how my parents met and some of their differences. So my parents met, got married in Jacksonville. And because my father was foreman of a cattle ranch in the Okeechobee area, she moved down and they lived on the ranch in the foreman house on the ranch. And that went on for some relatively short amount of time. I don't know exactly how many months. It probably wasn't a year. When in the middle of the night, there was an emergency. There were some noises outside. My dad jumps out of bed, rushes out of the room to go outside and figure out what's going on with the cattle. What are these noises about? Whatever it wasn't a big deal. He ended up coming back into the house, crawling back into bed, running his foot down my mom's leg, only to figure out that he had stepped in a cow patty while outside and brought it back into the bed and bedroom. And my mom has always joked that that was the final straw that got them off the cattle ranch and got them back to Jacksonville, which is where ultimately both myself and my brother were born.
I can see why that might be a bridge too far. Let's get to Little Temperance. And you coming along, you were born in, you said you and your brother were both born in Jacksonville. And so talk about yourself, and I want to talk early life, the things that you remember, maybe what part of Jacksonville that you grew up in terms of, and because I want to connect all of this to a place that really does revolve around the water. When you talk about Jacksonville, I mean, it's surrounded. You can't get anywhere without, you know, going over a bridge. You're either dealing with the Atlantic Ocean or the St. John's River and those tributaries and distributaries. Tell me a little bit about early life for you in Jacksonville.
Yeah, it's great that you should ask. And it is that childhood in Jacksonville and that exposure to water in so many ways as a child that led me down the career path that I had. But to kind of dig into that a bit, as I alluded to, I was born in Jacksonville. My dad had family down in Okeechobee, and my mom had some family in other rural parts of the state. And we were a relatively poor family. So when it came time for summer vacation or holidays, we typically traveled and spent time with family. Mm-hmm. And that's, you know, how we enjoyed our time away. On many of these trips, we might go camping at one of the springs in Florida. That was a very common occurrence for my family. And on one particular trip, we were driving from Jacksonville down to Okeechobee. And this isn't so much about water, but it speaks to my interest in nature. We were driving, and for miles, I just saw all these trees that were cut down. I was in second grade, and I thought, what is happening? Why are all these trees cut down? And so I asked my mom, you know, why are they cutting down the trees? Why are they cutting down the forest? And she explained it was to build houses for people to live in. It was this massive subdivision that was being constructed. And I just remember, I was in second grade at the time. I wrote a poem about trees in the backseat of the car that day, which my mom, of course, has kept through the years.
Of course.
It wasn't a very sophisticated poem, but I think it spoke to where my heart was at the time. And that was the first moment I knew, like, I cared about nature and Florida was a beautiful place, but Florida was a place that was changing. And then, you know, here I am visiting my cattle ranching family in Central Florida and growing up, seeing them and that way of life and understanding the relevance that agriculture has to our economy and our food supply, obviously, sure, here in the state. And so I started making connections between these things because of that. And because my family was very outdoor oriented, like I said, we went to a lot of springs, we did a lot of camping, we spent a lot of time fishing, whether it be, you know, on our inland rivers here in the state or, you know, offshore fishing. So I just had this growing interest in nature and in how that played into our way of life in Florida and why so many people wanted to come and live here. And yet, what a balancing act it was going to be to try to, you know, protect all these resources for us all to continue to enjoy them at the same time that we allowed for agriculture and economic growth. Of course, that wasn't the thoughts of a second grader, but I would say over the, you know, that's how it evolved for me over the years.
Yeah, it's like you kind of skip to where we're gonna join those things together, because I mean, it does seem like a perfect marriage when you look at what you do now and the role that you and the Nature Conservancy plays in Florida in particular, but also, you know, throughout the world. But let's back up to kind of walk our way into getting closer to that connection. And when you talk about those trips on the road and seeing in those days, and I was born or grew up in a neighborhood that used to be an orange grove, that used to be cow pasture. I know I think the picture, you know, that you're painting. Talk about whether or not, or to what extent, that began to inform what kind of subjects you liked in school. And I'm thinking more middle school, high school, when you're starting to make choices about the kind of subjects you're taking. You may be starting to think about what it is that you want to do when you go to college, you know, and beyond. Tell me a little bit about that.
Yeah, I would say there's kind of two threads that really fed into that at that point in my life. One was school and what was happening there, and I'll talk about that. And the other was getting involved in summer camps as a camper and then as a camp counselor here in Florida. So maybe I'll start with the camping first.
Sure.
So in, you know, middle school years, I started attending a camp along the Suwannee River that was affiliated with my church. And so I went with friends, and it was this great summer camp. You were there for 1 to 2 weeks. It was situated, like I said, right on the Suwannee River. It's where you learned how to canoe and camp and build a fire and how to identify birds and, you know, how to do archery. It was this great experience for me that I progressed through as a camper for many years, learning these skills and just having these magical moments at summer camp, to the point that I realized I wanted to train to be a counselor so that I could pass these things on to the next generation of kids like me and to the campers who came to the camp. So I started doing, they had a leadership training program there for campers to become leaders and future counselors. And that's really where I started building some of my leadership skills, ironically, that have helped me, you know, in my career and in many other ways in life, was through this camp, which of course just increased my appreciation for nature and recognizing the importance of those connections for, you know, the next generation and for youth. At the same time, of course, I'm in school. I went to Stanton in Jacksonville, which was a college preparatory school. We were very studious at that school and all wanted to be A grade students. And so I worked really hard in all my subjects, but I really found I was drawn to biology and the sciences in general, but biology in particular was something I really enjoyed, and it was something I excelled at comparative to some of my other coursework. And then maybe one of the linchpins was at our school, we had to do science projects every year. It was a very big part of that coursework and of mm-hmm. our grade for the year. Being the college-bound students we were very competitive. And so I did this very interesting science project on this crazy technology that was relatively new at the time called microwave ovens. And it, you know, it had to do with whether applying salt to your food before you microwaved it in an oven mm-hmm. would actually reduce it heating up and therefore cause more food poisoning. They had noticed this trend in food poisoning occurrences post-microwaves. So it was very cutting edge for the time.
Yeah.
And I did this science project on this and proved that yes, indeed, that was happening and that it's better to add salt after you microwave something instead of before. And went on to win the state of Florida's science fair competition that year. Or be one of the winners. And I got a scholarship in biology. And, you know, this kind of pat on the back in terms of my focus and interest in science. Mm. And so with that scholarship and with that focus on biology being something that I enjoyed and excelled at, I decided then that I wanted to study biology when I went to college. What wasn't immediately clear was I going to do medicine or was I going to do environmental, which maybe we can talk a little bit more about as we go here.
Yeah, let's start with the choice, first of all. You grew up, and I know this because I grew up going to Jacksonville, to Duval County, to Clay County, and knowing what I know about Okeechobee County and places like Pearson, you were dead in the middle of Gator and even Bulldog territory. And so it's almost sacrilege for you to choose Florida State at that point. But you did, right?
I did. Yes. Very good point. You're right. At that time in particular, mm-hmm. I mean, Jacksonville was the hot spot of whether you were a Gator or a Dog. And nobody talked about the Seminoles in Jacksonville,
right?
Which ironically was why I wanted to get far away from that. You know, my parents were in Jacksonville. Gainesville was awfully close. It was also where my grandfather lived at the time, and my parents visited him on a regular basis. So as a college student wanting to get a little further away from the family, I got into both universities, but I am proud to say I made the correct decision to study biology at FSU.
Was that the
and
point?
And get further from my parents.
There you go. I mean, you got to do a little bit, right? I chose the Army, but hey, that works
too. Oh, that's
too.
Even further.
a little bit. So did you choose biology as your major right off the bat? Was the idea is, hey, I'm going to see how this goes and maybe convert to pre-med? Tell me about that decision-making process.
Yeah, at that time, I was definitely expecting that I would probably go med, but that it was just as good to get a biology degree as it was to get a pre-med degree, and that the biology degree had, you know, was broader. So I signed up for a biology degree with an emphasis on taking a lot of coursework that was, you know, pre-med focused. Part of that scholarship that I won also included the opportunity to work as a lab research assistant on campus. Oh. And get paid. And I got matched with a microbiology lab at FSU. So got to spend some time really digging in on micro, which was something I really enjoyed and in part kind of paved the way for where I went from there.
Yeah, talk about, I guess, maybe the transition point. When was it? And was it working on things like in the lab, or was it something else, a class, professor, something that steered you to the point where you're like, I'm going to do environmental stuff, not medical?
Yeah, you know, it was a number of things. The micro lab that I worked in was actually doing groundwater analysis, which was interesting and, you know, wasn't really on the pre-med alignment. It was much more on the environmental side of the equation. And I really enjoyed that. I also realized I very much enjoyed working in a lab, but I didn't want to be behind a microscope all the time. And so I had thought about doing medical research and just thought maybe that's not the work environment that I'm interested in. And then at the same time, I think, yeah, more and more attention was, you know, I had always been a fan of nature and I had always recognized change, as I had told you. But I feel like in those college years, yeah, that call of action about what's happening, you know, to our planet mm-hmm. and some of the environmental movement stuff really started to speak to me.
Yeah.
And I started, and I took some more courses in kind of natural sciences, species science, mm-hmm. and was really drawn to it. And so I started kind of having this curve in my interest towards working on the environmental side of the equation.
Yeah, it seems to fit in with kind of your upbringing as well. Anyway, it's like if you're looking at something and it's like you spend your childhood, you know, outdoors, on the water, you know, visiting these natural places, that it's almost like there's this draw to it. Maybe talk about, as you're getting close to graduating, I know you ended up at the Florida Department of Environmental Protection, we'll just say DEP. Was that your first job out of college, or was there something else in between?
I had a very brief stint with the Tallahassee Chamber of Commerce right after college, and then I had a slightly longer stay at a private lab that analyzed water and soil samples, primarily for permitting purposes. So we were analyzing for things like oil and grease and surfactants and hydrocarbons and things of that sort. So that's where I was working for a lab when I actually had the opportunity to move to DEP.
Okay. When you actually ended up going to DEP, where did you start out over there, or did you go right into Everglades?
I went right into Everglades.
Oh, okay.
So
okay.
I was really fortunate to land a low grade, like environmental specialist OPS position in what at the time was called the Everglades Technical Support Section of DEP. Frank Nearhoof was leading that group at the time. And so, yeah, I actually got the job working there, helping with writing permit for Everglades restoration projects that were being constructed or implemented by the Army Corps of Engineers or the South Florida Water Management District. So that was my entree into DEP, was to land in this incredible place that was working on the Everglades and to step into this most unique role of writing restoration permits for for federal and state agencies.
Yeah. Let's take a minute to talk about my friends at Resource Environmental Solutions. Our state presents unique challenges with its diverse ecosystems, landscapes, and the many demands on its natural resources. That's why RES uses an innovative approach and creative solutions to help municipalities, agencies, and local water resource groups navigate the ever-changing landscape of environmental regulations in Florida and throughout the country. RES actively restores habitats, hydrological regimes, and ecosystem functions across Florida, from the Panhandle to the Heartland, to the Florida Keys and everywhere in between. They focus on restoring floodplains and wetlands and improving water quality, which benefits a wide array of species that call Florida home. With an unwavering commitment to Florida's unique ecological communities, RES upholds long-term stewardship practices, guaranteeing sustainable outcomes that endure. Discover more about their work and commitment to Florida's communities and the environmental challenges they face by visiting www.res.us. All right, now back to the conversation. So, I mean, then tell me a little bit about, I mean, there are a lot of phases, periods, epochs of Everglades restoration over the now, what, 3.5 decades, 4 decades now. At what point were you there in terms, like, what was the state of the Everglades? What was the state of restoration in those years? What year was it that you started there?
I started in 98.
Okay.
At DEP, right before Governor Childs passed away. So an interesting time, you know, in terms of the leadership at the gubernatorial level. In terms of Everglades restoration, the Everglades Forever Act had been passed. The water management district was beginning construction of some of the stormwater treatment areas and still really heavy into the research phase to figure out what were going to be the best, you know, options for addressing the water quality issues. And particularly, and this was another, like, I just feel very fortunate that certain doors opened for me and I was in the right place at the right time. So that's why I was there. You know, I got the job. I was helping write permits for some of those early stormwater treatment areas. And the pressure turned on to set the criterion for phosphorus in the Everglades. So the Everglades Forever Act had a time clock that said that, you know, DEP had to come up with that standard by a date certain. There was hope that we would be able to get an extension on that deadline. That was not granted. And we had to very quickly start moving towards taking all the data that had been collected by many entities and start doing the necessary work to develop the phosphorus criterion for the Everglades and then move through the rulemaking process for that. So that was a very significant point in time in terms of, you know, the Everglades restoration trajectory, if you will.
Yeah, I think, I mean, wouldn't you consider those the years where, you know, lawsuit or not, or, you know, deadlines or not, that really was the part where you started to reach some sort of acceleration? And, you know, from conceptual, we recognize we've got a problem here, into action. And it seems like right in that time period is when it really started to move forward a little quicker, with a little more purpose. I guess the question for me is, like, well, let me ask you this. Like, were you down there in terms of where you lived? Did you live down close to the Everglades? Did you work out of Tallahassee in those days?
Yeah, we were working, our whole group was working out of Tallahassee, but spending a lot of time in West Palm. We were, you know, down there.
Right.
And probably 3 weeks out of a month coordinating with the federal and state partners, because as you point out, that was a very busy time. The technology had been proven up, that, you know, stormwater treatment areas were the tool everyone wanted to use. There were very tight deadlines to get those built. There were tight deadlines to set the phosphorus criterion and then start putting that number in permits. There was, you know, a lot of activity. And at the same time, the Comprehensive Everglades Restoration Plan was kicking up,
right,
and really starting to go on its own trajectory.
Yeah. And so I guess maybe I'm trying to pull things together in terms of you individually, but in the context of the broader goal there, which, you know, has to do with the Everglades. And so I guess what I'm asking is, or getting to rather, is you, at some point you transitioned to the South Florida Water Management District. Was part of that decision-making, that kind of new SERP era and the moving forward era, it was that part of why you ended up going to the Water Management District, was because maybe you were closer to the action in terms of implementation? Maybe just talk me through that just a little bit in terms of what your work looked like and then toward that transition and your decision-making there.
Yeah, great question. I loved my job at DEP and I love the role that they play in all of this restoration work. So I was very happy at that point. I had experience writing these restoration permits. I had helped set the phosphorus criterion. We were figuring out how we were gonna work together to implement the Comprehensive Everglades Restoration Plan. But to your point, a lot of the action was actually happening, of course, in the Everglades in South Florida.
Right.
So there was a draw there for me to be, you know, on the front lines, if you will. And it was also at an interesting moment in time when, not to make this a bigger story, but we know when it comes to the Everglades, it always is. But this is when the emphasis on Lake Okeechobee and the estuaries was starting to happen. So before I moved down to the water management districts, when some of the algal blooms were really, you know, hot in the press, there were lawsuits being filed, and Governor Bush had announced, along with the legislature, had announced what at that time was called the Lake Okeechobee. It was called Lower Lake Okeechobee and Estuary Recovery Plan. So it was Governor Bush trying to kickstart some of the work in the Northern Everglades. That it wasn't called the Northern Everglades at the time, but recognizing that we couldn't just work on the south, you know, the bottom of the system and resolve the issues. So I was asked to come down to the Water Management District to help them kick off that program that Governor Bush had announced, which was expediting projects north of the lake and in St. Lucie and Caloosahatchee. And it was the beginning of what we will now all know as, you know, Northern Everglades and many things that have come since then.
Yeah, I'm curious, just from the family connection, was there any intersection in terms of, you know, family members that may still be in and around Lake Okeechobee and the work that you were starting to do there?
Yes, actually, yeah, very much so. You know, coming from the kind of family that I came from, there was a fair amount of distrust for anyways. And then there were all this talk about big projects happening in the areas where they live. So the Kissimmee River restoration work, for example, and the tie-in to Lake Okeechobee. So some of my family has, you know, family land, multi-generational family lands and ranches north of Lake Okeechobee in the Bassinger area. And there was a time when the Army Corps was working on the restoration plans for Kissimmee River, when they literally met with some of my family members and said, we have to have this land your family farm is on, multi-generational. It's going to be necessary for our Kissimmee River restoration work. And the family was devastated and, you know, did not want that to happen. And all these memories are on this property. The Army Corps continued to insist it was going to be necessary. It was in the impacted footprint from the project. And this saga continued for a few years.
Right.
So while this was happening, every time I'm around family, I'm getting an earful.
I'm sure.
You know, government is coming to take our family's land. Ultimately, and this is kind of a double-edged sword, I guess, ended up being outside of the impacts of the project. And therefore, the land does still remain with my family now. But just that saga that they felt like they went through left them with some scars and just left me with the appreciation of all sides of the story, right? I mean, yeah. I know why we're doing restoration. I know why we need some of these lands, and I know the impact it can have on adjacent lands for the greater good. And yet I also know what it feels like to be, you know, a multi-generational property owner faced with the possibility of losing your land.
Let's, and I hate to short circuit the time at the district, you know, in that restoration, but I think maybe it's a good time to transition in terms of talking about where you were philosophically and what that experience may have done to inform your work as you transition to the Nature Conservancy. And I think you started there in what, 2014, is that right?
Yes.
Okay. Well, I want to hear about how you made that decision to go there. But then, you know, I think I want to make sure that we explore a little bit some of these tools that you picked up along the way, you know, whether it was, you know, being a kid and the traveling and the family, but also that maybe some of that direct contact with landowners around Lake Okeechobee that, you know, that may be a good indicator of your abilities to work with folks, I would say probably almost certainly on a less acrimonious level with your TNC work, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And definitely a reason I ultimately came to TNC. So to your point, I was at the Water Management District. I was, you know, happily doing my job. We were very busy with all of these various restoration programs that we were trying to implement. And I had the opportunity to work with a lot of different entities during that time. And the Nature Conservancy was among them. And, you know, I had a lot of respect for the Nature Conservancy because of the way they worked and how they partnered. You know, they were known for working with agricultural landowners and promoting farm bill programs and for trying to come up with win-win solutions. And so I was a fan of their model, if you will. When I was contacted then by a recruiter because they were in the position of trying to find the new state director for the Nature Conservancy in Florida. And someone from the Water Management District, no less, had shared my name with them. And so here I am happily, you know, working for the state, trying to implement this restoration work, and then having this opportunity to potentially go work for an organization that I have tremendous respect for, their model, yeah, and be able to work on these issues statewide in my home state.
Sorry to interrupt you. I just don't want us to get away from maybe the kind of that kickoff. For those that don't know about, or at least not much about, Nature Conservancy, and they can go back to listen. I think we maybe talk a little bit about it with Greg before, but can you just, for listeners, like, what is that Nature Conservancy model?
Yeah, so we're a global organization now. We started in the U.S., and we started as an organization that was focused on land protection. But we've really grown to where we work on an array of issues, and I'll say a little bit more about that.
Sure.
But what's core to TNC's model is that we focus on people and nature and the intersections between them, and we are looking for wins for both. And so, you know, historically what that looked like was TNC identifying lands that were potentially going to be impacted by development and raising our own money and going in and buying that land and protecting it. So we weren't filing lawsuits or, you know, creating rallies against this particular development. We were figuring out how we could acquire and protect it. Mm-hmm. And then we moved from over the years from just the, you know, fee simple acquisition protection to trying to find ways to do what we now all call conservation easements, mm-hmm. which is, you know, working with landowners so that they actually continue to own the land and manage it, but that certain protections are in place on that property to make sure it maintains some of the other values it provides to us from an environmental standpoint. And so because of that history, you know, TNC grew as an organization that really wanted to work and collaborate with landowners and with the agricultural industry, and who was trying to find, again, those solutions where all boats rise and it's a win for everyone. And so that model, we moved from just focusing on land protection to realizing the topic for today's discussion. If we only protect land and they don't have adequate water supply and clean water for these natural land resources, then we really haven't done what we hope to accomplish. So we expanded beyond just protecting land to thinking about how do we protect fresh water.
Right.
And then, of course, the logical extension there is, well, what about our marine resources? And so now we look at all of those issues, but through this lens, again, of partnership and collaboration.
And I guess maybe that's, you know, part of like that kind of fulcrum point for TNC. It seems like what you've mentioned, which is collaboration, a heavy emphasis on that, regardless of who you're talking about. And that can be landowners that you're looking at in terms of protecting property, marine resources, government itself. Everyone seemed, at least in Florida, and of course I can't speak for, you know, everywhere in the world where TNC operates, but my guess is that one of the secrets to its success is that focus on collaborating and figuring out ways to get people to the same point in a happy way. Is that fair?
Yes, exactly. We are fans of the carrot when we can find those. And, you know, if you look hard enough, you usually can find those. We use a lot of innovative financing and other market tools, actually, to provide these win-wins.
Let's take a minute to talk about my friends at Sea and Shoreline. Since its inception in 2014, Sea and Shoreline's unmatched experience with scientifically validated methods of aquatic restoration has proven successful across more than 150 environmental projects. The company continues to be the industry leader in rehabilitating threatened and corrupted aquatic environments with proven success in places such as Crystal River, Homosassa River, the Caloosahatchee River, and the Indian River Lagoon. I've seen firsthand how Sea and Shoreline completely reset the ecosystem in Crystal River, transforming from a mucky, algae-dominated system to one with plants that actually belong there. The water used to be full of Lingbia and Hydrilla, with a thick bottom layer of muck that smelled like rotten eggs. But with Sea and Shoreline's comprehensive muck removal and planting of native eelgrasses, the system is now beautiful, crystal clear, with lush eelgrass meadows. The manatees are feasting, fish have returned, ecotourism is booming, and property values have significantly increased. Sea and Shoreline is committed to restoring and preserving Florida's communities and aquatic ecosystems because they're Floridians, and these are their communities too. To find out how you can partner with Sea and Shoreline to help your community, visit them at www.seaandshoreline.com. You'll be glad you did. All right, back to the conversation. Let me ask you about, because I want to get into some of the projects, and our friend Garrett Wallace, and I had some discussion with him before you and I were able to get this chance to talk. And I think he just knows me well enough to know that he's going to throw in some Northwest Florida projects in here. And so there's a few different ones, and I want you to talk about maybe an examples of both types, but I want to give you the opportunity to talk about one of those marine resource projects. And I'm talking about the Pensacola East Bay Oyster Project, not just because you're involved, but also it involves an organization which I'm particularly fond of, which is the Estuary Program over there in Pensacola and Perdido Bay. Can you talk a little bit about that project and why TNC is involved in that?
Yeah, absolutely. And it is such a great project that's ultimately going to have an impact far beyond Pensacola And to our staff's credit, it started many years ago when, after the Deepwater Horizon oil spill, and in the face of that, and knowing that there would be funding sources coming to the states along the Gulf, and communities wrestling and agencies wrestling with, you know, what to do with those funds and how to put them to good use, our staff started working with 5 watersheds along the impacted areas of Florida. So this is our Florida TNC staff. Said, okay, we want to start working with these communities. We want to start identifying what challenges they're having and what solutions we might want to implement before the money is actually available, so that when they have the fund, when the funds start flowing, we have a good idea how to use the money wisely. So our staff convened community-based groups in 5 large watersheds, Pensacola, Perdido being one of the 5, and proceeded to develop these community-based plans around what the challenges and opportunities were. And from that plan was born many follow-on efforts in multiple of those watersheds, including the idea that now that we have a good idea of the watershed as a whole and what some of the challenges are in that, how can we develop a program to address those challenges? And Florida, having had a successful history with national estuary programs, because as you know, we have multiple in the state.
Right.
The idea was, why don't we try to stand up an estuary program so that in the long run, we have an entity who's thinking about these things, you know, waking up, thinking about these things, and making sure that all these needs in the watershed are tackled comprehensively. So that led to taking these community-based watershed plans and then making the case to actually create estuary programs in these watersheds, whether they be congressionally endorsed national estuary programs or estuary programs that we find a way to put the glue to, you know, to keep them together.
Right.
That effort started to play out, and Pensacola Perdido was one of the watersheds that was most promising in terms of moving to an estuary program.
Yeah.
And it was a place where I can talk about this more if you want me to go there, Brett, is
sure.
Where we had a lot of opportunity around oyster restoration and need. And so that's one of the specific efforts that we've spawned from the original plan, and that the estuary program is helping to keep moving forward.
Yeah, I think, I mean, well, one is like, I'm, you know, obviously a bit biased here. It's like, but one is, I mean, they have a great board. I think they're actually getting close to that national designation, no small thanks to the Nature Conservancy. But I also think that having a great board amongst those local governments there, having a phenomenal executive director in Matt Posner, who's, you know, also a great human being in addition to to being a great director, I mean, I think that that seems like that you're going to breed success with something like that. Maybe briefly address the importance of oysters, especially when we talk about the Gulf Coast. We have some, you know, places further east that are, you know, nearly completely, if not completely, desiccated of oysters. But putting them back in is no small feat, right? So why do it in Pensacola and Perdido Bay?
Yeah, well, the why for oyster restoration anywhere, really, and then I can speak more to Pensacola, Perdido Bay, is, you know, oysters are phenomenal in that they have these like 3 services that they provide that are interrelated but unique, in that they provide habitat. You know, they create this structure that fish and other animals want to use, so they can create, you know, kind of a whole ecosystem around themselves. They are a fishery themselves, so they provide food for humans like myself who like oysters,
right,
as well as others. And they're tremendous at cleaning water. They filter water continuously and do a great job of removing a lot of pollutants and a lot of things that prevent the water from being clear and is healthy. So they provide this great free filtering service when they're there.
Yeah.
And because of all of those things, many of our economies along the coast of Florida, and frankly, all along the Gulf Coast, many of them have roots in the oyster industry, or the, you know, the implications of having oysters in their community. And yet we've seen massive die-off of oysters and loss of oysters for a whole host of reasons. So that is why it's a focus for us. They provide all of these incredibly important services. They were a part of the way of life in our communities along the coastline, and there are opportunities to restore them. We've done a lot of oyster restoration work as the Nature Conservancy and many different places. And there's a lot of different technologies and approaches that you can use, some better than others, depending on the location. But our great team of scientists in TNC Florida have been working to build out a very comprehensive oyster restoration plan for all of Pensacola, and have started by getting some actual restoration out in the estuary that has been successful and that they hope to build on over the years.
How much of that is due when you look at, and it does happen, like there are people that try to restore oysters and it's a giant disaster, and then sometimes it works. How much threshold of pain does the conservancy have for that sort of experimentation, for failing to end up succeeding?
I think we have a lot. I mean, and I think that's one of the things that we can offer that maybe some others, you know, agencies or others aren't able to. And I mentioned it earlier, we like to be innovative and we like to be, you know, science-based. We're certainly not afraid of an experiment, and we're not afraid of an experiment that, you know, may appear to have failed, but maybe we learned a lot from. So yeah, we've had some oyster restoration projects that weren't particularly successful, but what we've learned from that is you have to really understand the location and the waves and the water levels and all of these things in that location in order to design the proper type of restoration. And then you need, you know, solid contractors or volunteers to help you actually implement that once you have that good plan. And then we do a ton of monitoring to see, is it working as well as we thought it would? In the case of Pensacola, we've gotten great repopulation, natural population of oysters out there since we did the initial work of our own.
Let me switch gears, and I want to talk about one other project, but I really want to lead you toward TNC today, TNC as a whole, because there's some stuff that I'm interested in terms of these 2030 goals that TNC has. But quickly, if you don't mind, talk about the Bluffs, and I want you to mention it, because it's one of those things where my guess is that you're often the victim, but sometimes beneficiary of circumstance, and there had to be some really enormous circumstances had to happen to make the Bluffs possible to begin with. Can you talk about that just a little bit?
Yes, for sure. And you're absolutely right. Persistence and patience are things we have to deploy a bit of as conservationists. And this is a story of that for sure. So you're referring to Bluffs of St. Teresa,
right?
A property that's located, you know, loosely, I'll say, you know, between Tallahassee and Apalachicola. It's in the panhandle of Florida. And there's actually another property by the name of Lake Wimico in the same geography and kind of the same story. So these are big parcels of undeveloped land in a landscape that TNC, federal and state agencies, and many others have been trying to protect and kind of piecemeal together over the years. It's a really important, resilient connected corridor, mm-hmm. that we want to protect. TNC, some years ago, multiple of these parcels were part of a big package owned by a large landowning conglomerate, and they had come on the market. It was very surprising that this big package of lands was going to be available.
Right.
It was more than TNC wanted. It included some lands we weren't particularly interested in, but it included a lot of lands that were high priority lands for us. And this predated my time with the chapter. Mm. But we made our, and we took our best swing at trying to acquire this big slate of lands from this landowner. And we failed. We were not the highest bidder. And so another landowner acquired that portfolio of lands. And, you know, us being who we are, we kept our eye on the properties and thought, you know, you never know what would happen. Maybe the opportunity may present itself later. Mm. And that's exactly what happened. So that landowner decided, they looked at the portfolio and decided these were lands they wanted to keep, and these other lands were lands that they were willing to part with. And fortunately, two parcels we were really interested in were willing to part with list. They were still large acquisitions. They required significant amounts of cash. They involved collaboration with, you know, the governor, the legislature, and state agencies. But we were able to work collaboratively with all those entities and acquire both of those parcels. And ultimately, the acquisition of those two parcels means we put together over 1 million acre patchwork quilt corridor of lands that those two pieces were essential in order to make possible.
Yeah. Yeah, that was, I mean, that was something to see that come together, you know, with, I mean, and we're talking massive parcels of property, even the ones that you ended up with on that patchwork. I mean, still, you know, tens of thousands of acres, but I want to say like a 500,000 acres at play, something like that overall. And so what a story, what an accomplishment for TNC and its partners. Let's move, if you don't mind, let's talk about a few maybe policies, you know, programmatic level things that TNC is looking at. And maybe part of it is like, how does your Southern U.S. division fit into, I'm using my quote fingers here, goals for 2030 for the Nature Conservancy? Maybe talk a little bit also like about climate strong communities. I'm curious about that as well.
So the Nature Conservancy went through an exercise driven by our scientists and, you know, some of our policy folks that kind of, you know, asked a couple questions. One was, given the trajectories on the planet for biodiversity loss and terrestrial freshwater and marine systems, which, by the way, biggest loss that we've seen has been in the freshwater systems, and they're in the most dire straits of all. So when you look at the biodiversity loss that we're having and the climate change projections that are out there, and you look internationally at kind of the call to action from many countries around those two things, TNC wanted to be very aligned with those global calls to action around biodiversity and climate. And we wanted to ask ourselves, how much do we think we can contribute towards those goals, either solely as TNC, or more importantly, in collaboration with partners, where we can help make sure the flywheels are turning, ours or our partners and agencies, so that we can have maximum impact towards those goals for the planet. So that exercise turned into what we at TNC call our 2030 goals. So it's you know, very clear set of numbers around biodiversity and climate that we hope to achieve by 2030, either by ourselves or, more importantly, in partnership with others. Sure. So we have that set of goals, and we've also ground truthed those goals and broken those goals down by smaller geographies. So in my case, I oversee the southeastern U.S. for TNC. I have 10 states, from Virginia and Kentucky on the north end down to Florida and over to Louisiana. And so our team looked across those 10 states and asked ourselves, how much do we think we can contribute towards these goals by 2030? And given that, for example, this Southeast U.S. has a global hotspot for freshwater biodiversity, we're one of, you know, three or four places on the planet that are globally important for freshwater biodiversity. That is a place, for example, and there are others, that we, the Southern Division, the states that I work with, have the potential to have an outsized impact towards these larger goals that TNC has set for ourselves.
Let me ask you a question from a perspective of, you mentioned the 10 states that you work with and oversee. How much of your time, in terms of what you're able to pursue, you know, on individual states, compared to, say, you've got to deal with, you know, these more global issues, national issues, or how do you manage your time and effectiveness to be able to move forward with your 10 states, given the context of, hey, we also have to deal with folks in Washington, D.C. We also have to deal with our organization writ large. What does that look like for you in terms of just your management style or how you manage your days, your time?
Yeah, the dilemma of a day in the life. You know, I would say, fortunately, my 10 states have very, very strong teams that know their places, their geography, their politics. And it's why TNC's always stayed true to this model of having, despite the fact that we work globally and nationally, that we still need these kind of boots on the ground, local knowledge and local relationships, or we're not going to be successful. So I do count on them for that local perspective, and I don't really get in and micromanage that very much. But my job, and what we're trying to evolve as an organization, is to do better across borders. Mm-hmm. You know, we know our natural systems are not particularly tied to our geopolitical boundaries, and nor are they our organizational boundaries. So I spent a lot of my time trying to figure out in my division, in my 10 states, how can we do a better job of working across our borders, as well as with our, you know, adjacent borders. So, for example, you know, we're at the south end of the Mississippi River. Mm-hmm. And so we have many states working on Mississippi River issues, and we need, there's an important role we need to play in that bigger picture, being the southern end of that system. And so I spent a lot of time with my colleagues helping make sure we're making those connections. And then, you know, helping my leadership at the North America level and at the global level by providing perspectives from, you know, where we sit at the division, right, and state level. Yeah.
And I know it's like there's a ton. We could probably do four shows just on what you're up to and what the work in these great states are up to. But maybe kind of, I want to, at this point, I know I've taken a bunch of your time, and I've got some kind of usual closing questions that I have. But before I do that, maybe can you give folks an idea of what they should do if they wish to get involved, and we hope they do, with the work of the Nature Conservancy?
Yeah, sure. I'd be happy to. And yes, we will take all the interested parties that we can get. So again, I mentioned that we have staff and chapters is what we call them in every state. And so I would encourage folks to go online, tnc.org, and you can find out information about what we're doing around the world and what we're doing in the South, what we're doing in your state. It gives you the ability to drill in at all of these different scales to the work that we're doing to learn more. And when you're in the websites, you'll have opportunities to become a member, to donate, to look for events that we have coming up that may be informational, or field trip opportunity that we have coming up, or how you might get involved in policy issues that we're working on. So I would say getting online or social media, we have all the social media channels, and checking us out or reaching out to their local office here in the state of Florida.
That's great. And for those of you listening, is like, just pop on down to your episode notes and you'll find all those links there. Happy to put them there and encourage you to get involved. All right. So here we go. The first two questions can be kind of joined, but I treat them as separate items for a reason, because they're, one speaks to optimism, the other speaks to fear of a sort. And so I'll start with, are you optimistic about the future of the environment and natural systems? And let's limit it to Florida for this particular conversation. And either way, why?
And this may not be a fair answer, but I'm going to give it to you. You can say what you want to say. I mean, I would say I have mixed emotions, even when I'm thinking specifically about Florida. I feel like people in Florida value nature. We're in tune with it. It's why we want to be here. And so, and that's more true than it is in a lot of other places around the world, where people feel detached and don't necessarily see the value that they're getting from, you know, their environment and their natural resources. So that gives me hope. And, you know, nature and water in Florida have been nonpartisan issues for the most part. And that gives me hope. What worries me is that we have to start making tougher decisions now to prevent impacts, some of which we'll see now and some of which we won't see for generations to come. And so I guess I hope that we can lift our heads enough to recognize that and start making some of the tougher choices that we have to make, preserve all of this for ourselves.
No, I think that's fair. Yeah, I mean, and that's the thing. The second question is, what keeps you up at night? And so maybe I'll use that question to ask you to tease out an example of a tough decision.
I'm trying to tie them together. I can tell you what keeps me up at night, and I can tell you about some tough decisions.
Okay.
You know, I mean, what keeps me up at night in the biggest sense is recognizing that if we don't change the trajectory on some of these things, I am fearful about what the future holds for us if we don't start managing our water resources more carefully. Because when we start having cross-border, geopolitical, multi-country disputes about water, that is going to be, I think there's an inevitability there, and it's a very scary one. So that's the kind of stuff that keeps me up at night, thinking about when we start fighting world wars over water, for example, not to be doomsday.
No, no, it's like I'm soliciting people's best doomsdays. So I think that fits the bill. Let me switch gears on you a little bit and ask, what professional accomplishment, or maybe just pick one that you're really, really proud of? Doesn't have to be the one you're most proud of, because that may be a 10-way tie for first place. But give me an example of something you're really, really proud that you've done.
So I would say one of the accomplishments I'm most proud of in my career that stems from my time at the Nature Conservancy is when I came in as the state director for the Florida chapter. I came at an interesting time. It was the 2008-09 recession. Money was very tight in the chapter because the chapter had historically funded a lot of the work through the Florida Forever program. But at that time, funding for the Florida Forever program was less certain and waning. And so I came in a time when we had to start shifting gears in terms of our funding model. And so I helped the chapter set a strategic plan and launch its first fundraising campaign in over 20 years, $140 million campaign to try to move the needle on some of these important issues in Florida. And we were successful in completing that campaign and achieving our goals.
Nice. All right, last question. What advice would you give to a young person who is just entering or may have some interest in entering the environmental field? And that could be whether it's through public service or even in the private sector.
Well, first off, I would absolutely encourage them to do that, encourage them to pursue a career in this field. This is such an important field. What we're doing is critical. It's growing. It's a field that's it's growing, and the need for it's growing by the day. I can't imagine a scenario where this kind of work becomes obsolete. If anything, it's only going to become more and more important. Mm. And so I would absolutely encourage them to pursue it because it's fulfilling and rewarding, and the planet needs them.
Agreed. Thank you so much for being so generous with your time, Temperance Morgan. It's been a real pleasure. Thanks for coming on.
Mine as well. Thanks, Brett. Appreciate it.
You got it. Well, that's it for this episode. Thanks for listening to Water for Fighting. And thank you once again to Rez and CN Shoreline for making it possible. If you're enjoying the show, please be sure to subscribe on whatever platform you use. And don't forget to leave a 5-star rating and review. You can follow the show on LinkedIn and Instagram at FLWaterPod. And you can reach me directly at FLWaterPod@gmail.com. Send me your comments and suggestions for who and or what you'd like to know more about. Production of this podcast is by Lonely Fox Studios. Thanks to Carl Sorn for making the best of what he had to work with, and to David Barfield for the amazing graphics and technical assistance. A very special thank you goes out to Bo Spring from the Bo Spring Band for giving permission to use his music for the podcast. The song is called Doing Work for Free. You should check out the band live or wherever great music is sold. Join me next time for another amazing conversation with someone who has helped shape water and environmental policy in the Sunshine State. Until then, keep your whiskey close and your water closer.